in the now.
Everybody, this is VR, pitch hitting for host Slip Mode, and welcoming you to the listening pleasure of In the Now. And joining me today is Captain Bob.
This is Bob, Captain Bob.
Thank you, Bob. And our co-host today, Slip Mode.
Oh, the co-host.
Okay.
Yes, this is the January 11th show for 2004, first show of the year.
Woohoo.
Woo! All right. Well, we have lots of information as usual, and here we go with it. All right. Well, Japan's always been a big leader in technology, and I know that they're one of the bigger pushes to move to IPv6, but they did something that no one's done yet. They've actually have a whole three-digit area code for a whole... it's a voice over IP, so everyone that's actually on that area code is calling, and their calls are going out over voice over IP, which you're getting the benefits of voice over IP. Let me read the pitch. With its new three-digit telephone exchange, Japan has become the largest country to have federal regulators endorse mass migration to internet-based telephony. The new three-digit 050 exchange switched on last month works similar to U.S. area codes, but instead of dialing a different locale, it allows plain old telephone service, which is called POTS, to seamlessly transition to voice over IP.
Well, now, what is the benefit of voice over IP?
It's free, it's cheap. It's not free, but it's very cheap.
Well, it's like when you go through certain highways across the United States, you may go over a tolled highway, right? So basically, all of our long-distance carriers are tolled highways to get our conversation to one other place. With VoiceOver IP, basically you call into your local provider, and what it does from there is it will take the call, via if it got there via the phone or got there through data or whatever, it will get sent out through the internet and beyond those tolls, so you don't have to pay for those, and then you just pay for the sending of it out. So you're actually circumventing the telephone system.
Wow.
So it's going out through the internet, and then what it does is there's boxes, of course, all over the place that will then pull the call out and put it back on the normal telephone line and ring the other phone.
So it's just kind of using all local providers then?
Well, yeah, it's local, like, voice over IP providers. Phone companies are starting to do it. There are people that that's what their company does, period. You set up with them. You basically have a network connection at your home or business, and you call through that connection, and they will take the data and send it across to another location to eventually have it ring a physical phone line instead of the internet, and then it could call you. But there's also just doing it through the internet, so where it's just from your internet phone to another person's internet phone, and it never goes on the telephone system. There's no dial tone. There's no anything like that. So it's just like communicating over the internet.
Oh, wow, that could do away with the whole long-distance industry.
Yeah, which is why a lot of people are moving to it. And it'll be, I don't know, it's not going to be the standard in the future, I don't think. But I think it's going to be a competitive alternative.
Well, now, what does that do for, like, security and, like, eavesdropping issues?
Well, usually when you do voice over IP, depending on how you do it, it's just like routing something over the internet. I mean, if you have a provider that actually does it on leased lines to where they're routing the data just through the phone, I mean, not through the phone, but through this internet connection that they have that's not connected to the internet, then once it goes and, I mean, it's really complicated. It depends on how you're doing it. Let's just say it's a phone call coming from your computer and you're using a voice over IP service and it's going to be calling an actual phone number somewhere else. What it will do for security most likely is companies, and you'll have to pay for that. They'll be paying for sending it throughout the internet, and then it'll be higher paying for lease lines because it's more secure. The lease lines, nobody has access to it except for the provider, so nobody can see that. So that's the point for that. And then what it'll do is it'll eventually get to, a box that will then transition it to from the internet to, or not the internet, but basically a data connection to a normal phone call, and then put it back out over the phone system.
So it sounds like it can be in the future if the regulators allow it to, could actually become a higher cost in the future.
Well, a lot of companies, like phone companies and stuff like that, what they're doing is they're going to take their systems and how they connect long distance wise and transition over to fat fiber pipes. So everything, even if you call your local telephone company, what they'll do on their own business end, period, to save money is, okay, the point is that you can put more data on a large fiber optic line versus copper lines on the streets.
Right.
So it's cheaper for them to do it that way. Okay. So even if they're doing, if you have a provider that does voice over IP, or it's just the phone company just trying to, upgrade the technology that makes the system work cheaper for them, they're going to do it. So either way, most phone calls in the future will be going over data lines anyways.
Right.
If you consider it voice over IP where you're skipping the tolls, of that particular provider, that's one thing, or it's a provider trying to offer cheaper long distance because it can do it cheaper. And then the benefit, too, of doing it versus on data is that you can do, codecs and compression of the audio to make, I'm getting really technical, but a typical telephone phone line carries 64 kilobits of data. So a T1, I think, is like 24 phone lines, so it's 24 phone lines times 64 kilobits of data, which is the 1.544 megabits, whatever. But if you use compression on a T1 and you're doing your voice over IP over that, you can actually get your conversation down to 5 kilobits a second versus 64 kilobits, because what it does is it'll limit things like dead air. If I say, it'll remember that I said for a period of time. So what it'll do is it'll take a snapshot of the and then it'll tell it to carry it for so many microseconds.
Oh, just like loop it.
Yeah, so there's so many things that it can do. If you notice on your cell phone, if you have a digital cell phone, in the background, if you have like background music, or let's say you call somebody and they put you on hold, my phone does this, and I know other digital phones does. If they put you on hold, the background music is so light and so kind of like mixed together,
uh-huh.
it actually takes it and says like, well, this is noise, and drops it. So I don't even hear hold music most of the time.
Huh.
Which I think that sucks, but
I think that's fantastic.
Well, I mean, unless the music.
Well, unless it's good music, because I've only encountered like once or twice where it's like, hey, you know, put me back on hold. Your hold music's great.
Yeah, you guys suck. Hold music, good.
I didn't want to call you anyway.
But yeah. So. Yeah.
But I still smell that because they're doing more, and most companies will when they have to do more, even though it's cheaper for them, they're going to want to try to charge you more in the future.
Oh, yeah. It's all about making the consumers happy, yet getting that steady flow of cash.
And especially, they can pull the scam of, would you like our unsecure line, or would you like to pay a little extra and have our secure line?
Yeah. Well, they do have to pay extra for lease lines. So.
But it's really all kind of, you know, in their operating costs. So they're eventually it'll...
You know, oh, yeah,
be a huge profit margin for them.
Totally.
When it should just be status quo.
Kind of like the way the telephone company is now.
Yeah.
Yeah, which that there, the FCC tax that's on your phone bill, that is taxation without representation. You know that? Because all of the commission are appointed, not elected, but they can tax you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very un-American.
So is a lot of things Americans do.
Yeah. Sorry, that's my little stick at the phone company right there. That's just against liberty.
Well, we talked last show about OnStar, and now people are modifying them to circumvent using the service from OnStar themselves and just using their own equipment to control their car. Well, it's just a new article, I think, that came out, maybe sparked from that original one, that people are concerned, and I think we've talked about this before, concerned about having something like OnStar in their car. Well, if you don't know what OnStar is, it's basically a device in your car that unlocks, locks your car. It even checks your freaking, you know, if you go get your computer in your car, what the heck is it called? When they plug it in and they do the...
diagnostic.
Yeah, diagnostic. They could do a diagnostic, track your car, all sorts of stuff. Well, a lot of people are worried about some of the things that it could possibly do, and maybe it's not doing that now, but what if someone, for instance, with the article saying, what if someone, you know, hacker or whatever, I usually say creative criminal. Hackers are different than that. These are pretty creative criminals if they did that. That would go and, you know, get into your car and do certain things, possibly listen to you, you know, because you can actually, some of the cars are actually equipped where you can talk to an OnStar operator, and you're speaking to a microphone, and they're talking back. So,
yeah, so you could just, like, tap in and actually have an instant bug.
Yeah. So OnStar is one of a growing number of automated eyes and ears that enhance driving safety and convenience, but that also increase the potential for surveillance. Private advocates say that the rise of automotive technologies, including electronic toll areas, tracking our local tracking devices, black box data recorders like those found on airplanes, and even tiny radio ID tags in tires are changing the nature of Americans' relationship with their cars.
Yeah, they already have the little black box on them.
You know, my dad, actually, because he lives in Miami, and they have toll freeways on some of them, and he saw a news story about how somebody proved that a crime was committed by this guy because they knew his driving patterns because of the toll booth.
Ooh.
Yeah. You know, it's good that he caught the guy. Great. But all of a sudden, my dad said, well, forget that. I'm just going to start paying in quarters, because what you do is you drive by with this thing. It looks like a garage door opener.
Yeah.
And it just emits a signal all the time, and it says, boop, you know, I'm so-and-so, let me through. There's so much money out of my account. So, yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of that stuff going on. Obviously, it's going to be you know, great to automate things in society, but obviously there's a black side to it that...
just the whole OnStar thing is you can, like, drive around and do, like, almost kind of a war driving thing. If you want to hijack a car, you hack into its OnStar, tell it to shut it down. Disable the OnStar so they can't call. They go walking.
I'd be pissed off if a police officer pulled me over like that, turned my car off.
Yeah,
man, that would suck.
Well, actually, I would feel really invaded because it just took all control of my vehicle away from me. And possibly, you know, first time that it would happen and somebody, like, rolls over, you know, kills somebody, you know, then there's going to be some severe issues about that.
Yeah, you know. Having power is one thing, but the responsibility that goes with it is another. So these powers certainly do certain things, but the responsibility is even greater. So something gets easier in one aspect of automation and a service, but in the other aspect of responsibility of how to use that power, that is something that people have shown to abuse. So something
That's right.
to worry about.
Because power corrupts.
And... what is the other thing? Power corrupts and corrupts.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Yeah, that's it. All right, well, here is... we usually kick out some information about some scientific stuff, and we've always tried to talk about the weird science that's off in the future that obviously is technically related with like nanotube technology and integration between silicone and cell. Well, researchers have created... the very first ever integrated silicone circuit with nanotube transistors.
Ooh.
Very interesting.
When can I buy one?
Well, probably in 50 years. Researchers say the development brings them a significant step closer to using carbon nanotubes for memory chips that can hold orders of magnitude more data than current silicon chips. That's kind of a tough sentence. 10,000 times greater, according to some estimates.
Wow.
Or for sensors sensitive enough to detect traces of explosives or biochemical agents at the molecular level.
Imagine having like a 100 gig of RAM chip in your computer.
Yeah, you'd like...
yeah, I don't think the government would let us have that. We'd be able to, like, you know, crack missile codes and all that crap. You know, moving a Cray computer around actually requires, you know, a certain level of government clearance and stuff like that.
Mm.
But they're basically trying to get things built down on the molecular lower level. A nanotube, I think, is built of... I mean, it's actually built of living material? I think it is. I tried to read the article. It doesn't really describe that in detail. But...
traditionally, what I think of as nanotechnology is actually doing stuff at, like, the molecular level.
Yeah, with a living, you know...
Cyborg would be...
Cyborg.
The meshing between metal, you know, like a mechanism and organism.
Yeah.
Well, nanotechnology has nothing to do with the organism. Tiny. It just means, like... nano is in micro, it's very, very small. And so it's just kind of a step above, you know, like quantum computing, as we normally talk about and really enjoy.
It's basically nanotechnology is where they build something up atom by atom so that it can be very small.
Yeah, they don't machine it down but build it up from the molecular level.
Well, I know, but
really neat.
Well, that's what I mean. It's still... organism, it's not
not biological.
Yeah, like they'll take like a silicone atom, or well, it'll be more than one, but and then they'll build up, they'll build a RAM chip out of silicone atoms, like one at a time.
Okay, from doing it from those materials. Okay,
yeah,
like traditional how like silicon chips are made now is they take like a slate of silicon and etch it out.
Well, they don't etch it out, they actually it's a cool process. They put this, it looks like a picture. It has these lines, and they put it against it, and then they do this thing with light, and then it burns it all in there.
Yeah, well, they etch it, which is etching. But with nanotechnology, they take atoms and put it together and build it, and not, like, mill it down. They build it up.
Yeah, no, I knew that. I was just thinking that it was
cool stuff.
Organistic of actually, like, using silicone or something like that.
Well, now when you get into carbon, now you're... starting to talk about using stuff that is the basis of organic life.
That's
rather
what I mean.
Rather than silicon.
That's kind of what I was thinking about.
Okay. Because carbon's a really neat atom, that it has some interesting properties.
Yeah. I hang out with them all the time. No, sure. Okay. All right. Well, so making headway on that and making things smaller, faster, and definitely, you know, for technology, definitely not for the consumer market. This is off the wall, out there, futuristic stuff. All right. Well, earlier this month, there was a story about federal... What was that?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, okay. You were doing something.
Whatever.
All right.
We got a peanut gallery over here tonight.
So sweet.
You're missing out. Wait, oh, there should be video here.
Video would be nice. Especially with those women that we bring in sometimes.
Yeah, it could be like the Howard Stern show.
Yeah.
Like that would probably have to be a completely different show.
Well, federal authorities said that they thwarted an extortion plot against Best Buy Co. Inc. by a man who sent the company an email threatening to expose what he claimed were weaknesses in the retailer's computer systems unless he was paid $2.5 million.
I definitely believe that Best Buy should be required to tell their buyers that their computers come with Windows pre-installed. That way people couldn't extort it out of them for $2.5 million.
Oh, God. That was pretty good.
That's good. Yeah.
Basically, he sent one email telling him that he was going to do that, and then the second email came the next day, offering a step-by-step summary of how we are able to penetrate your website. That's what this quote. So it says, we. For $2.5 million, if Best Buy did not agree to the deal, the emailer would list all of Best Buy's customers and their credit card numbers on BestBuy.com. Well, the guy's name is Thomas E. Ray III. He's a 25-year-old guy in Jackson, Mississippi. And they busted his butt. And the federal search warrant that they obtained from the FBI allowed them, with Best Buy cooperation, to use an internet device known as the Internet Protocol Address Verifier. It contained a program that automatically sent back a response to Best Buy after the company sent a message to the email address. The response allowed investigators to identify Ray as the sender of the email threats, according to the government. So wherever he opened the email at, it kind of sent a little thing back saying, like, hey. Must have used Outlook for that, you know, running all that cool VB scripts and stuff like that. Put some FBI Lido VB in there. Some Java. Or some just Windows scripting, baby. So Ray faces up to a maximum of 2 years in prison. And a $250,000 fine for property and repudiation extortion. He faces a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison. What? Oh, for the property and repudiation of extortion. And he faces a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison and a fine of $250,000 for threats to damage computers. That's a lot.
Ooh,
that's
threatening?
Yeah.
That's insane.
5 years. The actual extortion and... repudiation extortion is 2 years. The threat is 5.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very just.
So if I get pissed at my computer and I threaten to hurt it and a cop is walking by, can he throw me in jail for 5 years?
It sounds like it.
That's what it sounds
like.
Yeah,
if he wants to press charges. Which, that doesn't make much sense. It's just,
I have to go home and apologize to my computer so it won't press charges against me.
Yeah.
Well, what I was kind of thinking about is, like, most internet kind of... extortion or hacking and whatnot doesn't get reported. So, kind of wondering if he wouldn't have gone so far as to ask for $2.2 million, but just like maybe $100,000, and then offered to fix it. What would have Best Buy done?
Here's my thoughts. It was exactly like that, but I put it in a different way. If he just contacted him and said, "Hey, I know there's this dangerous exploit in your website. You know, this vulnerability. And I'm a security consultant, and I would gladly come out and fix it for you. This is my cost."
Yeah, see, that would have been so much
$2.5 million.
Yeah,
right.
And at the same time, that's not illegal.
It is. Because remember, just for exposing a threat can actually be illegal.
Yes. Just like even mentioning the fact that it's possible that there might be a flaw.
Because
that sounds really inhibitive to evolution and productivity.
It is. Well, we had stories like this before. Because how did he find it out? He must have done it.
Yeah.
Well, not really, because...
Well, he doesn't actually... Sometimes you don't have to do it. Sometimes you'd be like, this would do that. But just by pointing that out, you can be sued. Which is stupid.
Which knowledge... I think that's insane. That Adrian knowledge Lama. Is that... That means that certain types of knowledge is really just illegal.
Yeah. Yeah, careful with that.
All right.
So, yeah, that's another thing. But I think they probably would have handled it a little bit nicer if he was like that.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, this is an interesting thing. It was kind of fun to see this. It's called the 101 Ways to Save the Internet. And,
Well, does it really need saving?
I think so. Not the... It's the crap that's on top of it. It's not the, you know... It's not the original intent of the internet needs to be saved. It's the crap that's on top of it. All right. Well, here is the kind of distractor. VR is working on a technical issue.
It should be better now.
Oh, man, it works again. No, just kidding.
Actually, I'm just a computer simulation. They have a mic jack hooked into my CPU, and I just respond in the appropriate way.
Oh, then what is your first protocol?
To serve slip mode.
What is your second protocol?
To serve slip mode.
And your third protocol?
To find porn on the internet.
Okay. Actually, there was a... I was going to do the 101 ways to save the internet, but no, let me just say this real quick. I'm trying to remember what it was. It's there was three rules that the guy that invented the first robot, that three objectives that every robot should have, he said. I'm trying to remember.
The
first one was like
don't
to serve the robot's master. Uh-huh. The second one was like to not bring harm to the robot's master.
Yeah.
And like the third one was something I don't know what the hell it was. It was like serve the robot's master without bringing harm to yourself and the master. I don't know what it was, but it was
probably just do not produce harm to yourself.
Actually, I don't think there was one for harm to yourself, because then you'll start turning into Hal.
That's true.
Yeah.
Or do not harm others.
I don't remember. It was interesting.
Or do not purposefully harm others.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, what was that movie? Yeah, what was that from?
Well, it's the guy that invented the first robot back in the early 1900s.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I vaguely remember some of that.
Let's see. Okay, well, here's number one. And I don't know if I agree with totally all the order of it, but okay. Unleash vigilante justice on spammers.
Hmm.
One activist has proposed filters that launch distributed denial of service attacks back at spammers. Great. Just make sure we have the right to we have the right addresses first.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll work. Most spammers don't usually.
No.
Not easily. They're not easy to track down.
Number two. This is a little self-centered, I think. Slash song prices. Charge 29 cents per download. You'll make up in volume.
Yeah.
I don't know. Why should that be number two, though? Isn't there more important things out there?
I don't think they're really in order. I think it's just a list of 101 things to do.
Okay. Number three. Quit already, Jack Valenti. Just die. Guy that's an RIAA. Okay, appoint Larry Lessig to the Supreme Court. Okay, create the all-in-one box. Email, phone calls, instant messages. They should all go into a single app. No, that's bad. That's bad. I don't agree with that.
Well, that could, lead to a huge exploit.
Yeah. Yeah. Putting all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah. That's usually kind of bad.
DOS on your phone calls.
Man, who wrote these rules? Now I'm starting to disagree with a lot of these here. Triple your cable modem speed. I mean, that's okay. But obviously those are for Kazaa users and big old MP3 hunkies and people like Bob over there that
puts up adult entertainment.
Full movies of, stuff that... Actually, I read an article that somebody had... who was it? No, it was a lad... I heard it on... Ben Rev, some guy has got a DVD ripper with these multi-processor machines. There are four processors in each box with tons of RAM, and he can rip DVDs instantaneously, and they're making a joke about pulling up to a Blockbuster, renting some movies, just going out of the car, ripping them in seconds, not seconds, but really freaking fast, bringing them back in, say thanks. Was that Voodoo? I think that was Voodoo.
You could do that like with their Freedom Pass. You could go and get like 10, 15 movies a day.
You're speaking from experience.
Quiet, Slip Mode. The feds are going to come knock down your door.
And say, hey, baby, where's that sexy guy named VR at?
Wait, I didn't do anything.
We need to get to Mars. No, just kidding.
Hey, I had a whole plot about getting to Mars. I actually had this whole plot where I was going to make this little cardboard tube rocket. Copyright my own flag and make it. And this is the beautiful thing. The whole propellant for this rocket was going to be a can of hairspray.
No, it was going to be Mountain Dew.
No, well, the can of hairspray was a little bit more controllable. Or actually, a can of upside down paint would be a little better. Then I was going to rent some space on the Colombian or the South American Space Project and have it sent up and place it in the proper orbit so that it was. Would be in time that the propellant from the hairspray would be remotely triggered by just a little solenoid. It would spray it and just send it on its way. Now, it eventually, at this time, when I thought of this idea, the Mars was actually getting closer. And so, feasibly, the can of hairspray would actually make it to Mars in a reasonable amount of time.
What's reasonable? Like 2 years?
Yeah, it would have been something like that. And so it would have been trapped in by the Mars gravity, and it would have plunged, you know, like head on into
folks,
it.
Don't place your bets on VR.
The whole cardboard tubing would go away, and the flag would actually be shaped as a dart, and would be penetrated into the ground, and there, my flag would be planted upon Mars.
Oh, come on. And then, you would never make it through the atmosphere, let alone traveling at 5 miles an hour for 30 million miles.
It would physically do it because there's almost no friction in space. So it would be in pristine condition by the time it hit the atmosphere. I think it's a little bit.
Here's what's going to happen, dude.
But see, let me finish the brilliant part of this.
Let me make a joke before you get.
All right, make the joke.
is that it's going to take so freaking long to get there? People are already going to be living on Mars, and then what's going to happen? It's going to come down and hit somebody in the head.
Well, actually, because there's
going to kill somebody, and your flag's going to be in someone's head.
By that time, I'd be long dead. But anyway, actually, the hairspray propelled rocket would actually keep accelerating until that can of hairspray was used up. So it
hairspray propelled cardboard rocket.
Uh huh. Now this thing would be going insanely fast through space,
and it would make it through the atmosphere.
It would actually hit the atmosphere. Most of the rocket would be destroyed, which would be the intent.
You're talking about that insanely hard cardboard out exterior?
No, it doesn't need to be insanely
hard. But the dart-shaped flag would survive the atmosphere.
Well, with the proper insulation.
What kind of... Are you going to be using, like, cloth for the flag that's going to burn up?
Actually, no. It would just be compressed carbon. That's all it would take. And then by the impact, the carbon would break off. My flag would be presented. So when the NASA, photo... satellite that they had sent would come around, take a picture of my flag, and all I'd have to do is drop a line to NASA and go, hey, you know what, you're taking a picture of my planet, you get to, you know, pay $1 per square foot of picture that you've taken.
And they're going to be like, we can just erase that flag.
All right, but what about what kind of resistance are you going to provide it? I mean, if you just let this thing fall down to Mars, it's probably going to bury itself like 20 miles underneath.
I could have put a parachute on it. I would actually have to have done some testing with it. But the atmosphere of Mars is substantially thinner than here.
That is true.
So it would actually just take a little parachute. Or a good-sized streamer, and it would slow it down too.
But there's no... The parachute doesn't really grab much. There's nothing to grab. I just watched that from the Mars lander. They put a parachute, and then they also have a rocket and a bunch of inflated balls around the lander. The parachute opens up as soon as it gets into the...
Atmosphere.
And then on its way down, just before it hits the ground, rockets fire to give it even less resistance and make the speed not as, you know, the descent not as fast, and then let the balls go, and, they would inflate and then go down and bounce, and they were, like, praying that even after all that it would still make it.
Well, that's because they have insanely sensitive equipment there that if it gets jarred more than, like, you know, 5 miles an hour, it could just disintegrate. But here I've got this really simple flag that, you know, that you could throw at 100 miles an hour and it would still serve its purpose perfectly.
See, this is actually brings me to the story of how I met VR. So my dog got ran over and I was very mentally distressed. So what they did was they had me talk to a psychiatrist and I met him in the lobby. And I was like, this guy can like talk up a storm about some stuff. So I said, he'd be really good. No, I'm just joking. Okay.
No, I actually reanimated his dog using household equipment.
Yeah. Hairspray.
And he's actually still walking around.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's read some of these other ones here. We still have a lot of information to talk about. Okay, demand truth in advertising for software updates. Okay. Declare spammers are terrorists. No, that's stupid. Hands-off internet phone calls. Just become the creaky old phone system. Oh, just because the creaky old phone system was regulated to death doesn't mean voice over IP shouldn't suffer the same fate. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because it eventually will, and it'll cost us more than what we're doing with right now.
Let's see. Free the handsets. We should be able to buy any cell phone and match it to any service plan.
I definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
I don't know what that has to do with fixing the internet, but I definitely agree.
Yeah, I like it.
How about this? Larry Flint to build a porn browser.
Oh, yeah.
It should cover our tracks coming and going.
Definitely.
Make email addresses portable. Aren't they portable?
Well, not really.
They're locked to a domain. It's not really possible to make them portable.
I don't know what really they mean with that. Don't let the Pentagon hog the airwaves. The DOD doesn't need that many civilian free radio frequencies to do its job. Oh, here's a good one. Dump the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Oh, good one.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely.
Stop the U.S. Patent Office before they patent the hyperlink.
Oh, my.
Oops, too late. They patented the hyperlink. Simplify web publishing. Let's see. Let's just read the good ones. Let 1,000 Wi-Fis bloom.
Wow.
Hmm. Build a .sex red light district.
Hey.
I said that a long time
ago.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Dot porn.
Dot XXX.
Yeah.
Or
then,
dot porn.
Then anything that's not, you know, that you have a porn site that's not there, then, yeah, you're out of bounds.
Let's see. ICANN, the committee that assigns top level, say they refuse to create an adult zone that can easily be kept from kids' eyes. Porn won't disappear, so deal with it. Okay, make privacy.
Porn is how the kids were created in the first place. Get over it.
Yeah. Make privacy a personal asset. Yeah. Let's see. Roll out GAAP for geeks. GAAP. Just as with accounting, create an industry standard for network security. Don't forget the penalties for companies that don't comply. Okay. Bring on the perp walks.
The what?
Perp walks. What you do is you gotta like walk. Like on television, like walk somewhere in the community so they know that that's the guy, the perp, pedophile. Take back UHF. Try to running into our wireless network on the same frequency as Mike. Take back UHF. I don't have freaking cable, and UHF is like the only way to get past 10 channels. Screw that. All right. Let's see. Offer real RIAA amnesty. Instead of telling us to delete MP3s and pay our fine, how about you let us pay a fair price to keep them?
Yeah, we spent hours, you know, collecting them.
Let's see. Release episode 3 on the net. It's going straight to video anyway.
And when you embezzle money, you can keep it afterwards.
Is it really going straight to video?
I don't know.
I hope not.
Pass a White Hat Protection Act. Hackers who find holes in corporate networks should get thanks, not handcuffs.
There you go.
Very good.
And the anti-spam toolkit. Should get that.
Yeah.
All right. Some other good ones in there. All right. Well, we'll move on to other stories. But, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there. Definitely fun stuff to look at. Okay. Well, what else do we have? Okay. This is something found very interesting here. Well, in certain programs and certain printers, they will not allow you to scan nor print
$20 bills.
$20 bills.
Specifically, only the new 20s.
Oh, so you could do any other bill, though?
Yes, you could.
Oh, okay. Well, that's really
just
hard.
Carry around a bunch of tens, baby.
Yeah,
exactly.
Very few people check those, too.
When I try to print on my Canon i850, only a small part of it would print regardless of the orientation or the size. Other printing programs result in the same results. I was able to cut a small part of the image and reprint it. When I tried to cut about half the image, Photoshop let you scan it in, lets you save it. And he's saying here that when I tried to cut about half the image, Photoshop informed me that was illegal and referred me to the webpage below, which is www.treas.gov/USSS/money_illustrations.shtml. It seemed as though the printer and software vendors are stepping past what is legally required. So they're getting more involved in...
Well, they were probably asked to do that, too.
Yeah.
So they probably got a little tax break or something out of that. It's a little...
Or something
judgment.
For, I don't know, being sued. I don't know, some sort of protection. Basically, some of the stipulations the government has is the illustration is of less than 3/4 or more than 1 1/2 in linear dimension, each part of the item illustrated, seeing you can't scan that in. The illustration is one-sided, and all negatives, plates, positives, digital storage medium, graphic files, magnetic storage, optical storage devices, and any other thing used in the making of the illustration that contain an image or of the illustration or any part thereof are destroyed and or deleted or erased after their final use. So there's a whole lot of information that they have on the digital copying of the currency. So
what you do is you go to Canada and get their currency and reproduce it. And then do the exchange rate. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Don't counterfeit U.S. money. Counterfeit Canadian money.
Go the easy route. Haven't we taught you people to think at all on the show about anything? At least take that from the show. Okay.
Well, there's always a loophole. And, that's my only
I think thing. We should issue a little disclaimer here. We're not telling you to go copyright money.
No, it was just critically thinking here.
I actually tested out in the $50,000 printer we had. Printed out really freaking nice.
That was it?
Yeah, really nice. Of course, the paper and everything was all wrong, but... All right.
And that's the biggest giveaway of anybody who handles money. Like, I've come across quite a few counterfeit bills, and all they do is they touch my fingers, and I turn it right back around at them. And go, you need to take that away.
And they say, huh?
Uh-huh, and they go, what? What are you talking about? And then I take the pen, and I write a big void on the bill. And there you go.
Well, I'll forget you, man. I spent $5 creating this fake $20 bill.
Well, that's tough going.
All right. Well, there is a small robot that's out there in the forest that they're using to monitor the environment and do all sorts of things. It kind of goes across this wiring system, like a bunch of lines in the sky, and it's looks like telephone lines all over the place, basically. And this thing rides those lines all over the forest and monitors certain things.
Well, what about the environmental impact of putting up those,
exactly,
those cables for
exactly
that?
Exactly what we need, cables in the forest.
Yeah, take those down, man, because they're, like, impeding somebody's process.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if they're going to put cables in the forest, can I at least get my broadband internet when I go camping?
Maybe.
Ooh.
Programmed with open source computer code Linux, the Treebot is a vital addition to researchers' environmental monitoring kit, according to the project leaders. So one of our objectives is to make use of distributed sensors to acquire information about the environment, and it's very important in the biological community to understand the interaction between the atmosphere and the forest environment. Understanding subtle changes in light, humidity, carbon dioxide levels gives scientists crucial indications and predictions about environmental change.
Yeah.
So it's out there. It's running on Linux. Cool.
Right on. Well, they probably chose that so they wouldn't have to go and track it down in the middle of 50,000 square acres of virgin forest to go and reboot it.
Yeah, that would suck. Oh, man, you got blue screen duty, buddy.
Dude, I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Where was it last at? Somewhere in this 1 mile radius. All right.
Yeah, it crashed about 20 minutes ago here. Now it's somewhere in this area.
Could be anywhere. It's on autopilot right now. It's just going. Tracking broke down. All right. Well, jumping around again. You know, I'm thinking that maybe I'm going to start getting less stories, less jumping, more, you know, stories that I can talk a lot about in depth and just stick to those.
I'm really enjoying them.
What?
These topics that we can really talk about in depth.
Okay, well.
I'm really enjoying it.
Okay. Well, I haven't heard any complaints from anybody. I was just kind of curious if people just didn't, you know, couldn't jump as fast as we're jumping here. Okay, well, if you keep up to date on things that happen out there with bugs and whatnot, the protection form for Microsoft's Word documents, the password protection has been broken.
Ooh.
So you can actually run a little exploit there and pull the password out of it, allow you to change it, insert the password again, and no one ever knew you did what you did.
You know, technically something has to be fixed or working in the first place to be broken.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
So you're really saying that it came out broken, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Never really worked. Someone just discovered that it didn't work.
Yeah, there you go.
And also...
That's an interesting way of looking at that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Or it never met expectations to begin with, so it never did work.
There we go. I feel sorry for the poor guy who
discovered
that.
But then it would
that.
Be broken. It just hasn't met expectations yet.
Yeah. It's
because in order to be broken,
just
it has to work. Yeah. You're right.
So when you exploit something that's inept, aren't you just making it more inept?
So wait. No, we do a lot of bashing, but so what? Microsoft never worked. Because it
never.
Just hasn't met expectations.
Exactly.
All right. Cool. Okay.
Well, that's the whole justification of all our bashing.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. There's just so many things mangled in there. It's just too much. Okay, well, I've been keeping track of, it was Mars Spirit, right? Is it Spirit?
Huh?
The lander.
Oh, yeah, Spirit.
Spirit, yeah. I've been keeping track
of Liberty,
that.
Right?
Liberty, actually, is Liberty the second one, or is it the first one, or which one's which? I think it's Spirit is the one that's up. I don't know. You know what? I feel bad because I'm keeping track of it, but I forgot the name. Well, I think with the loss of... you know, the space shuttle, and we've got the International Space Station up there just tinkering away. Actually has a leak in it right now. And one of the Mars probes from Europe didn't make it, the Beagle 2. They don't know if they made it or not. They just haven't been able to get in touch with it. And I think it was Spirit. Spirit landed.
It'll end up around Uranus.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I've been feeling. anyways, so... made it, and it's up there taking pictures and doing its job. And I think that, I don't know, I think Bush is trying to get involved in everything. He's trying to put the immigrants in, you know, so he can get some more of that vote so the Democrats can't pull him in or so the Democrats can't win because he's trying to, that's exactly why he's doing the whole immigrant thing. It's just
because they're actually the biggest, they're a good group of traditional Democrats. All immigrants, low-income, you know, the working class, are traditionally Democrats. And so he's...
I really think it's a freaking snake move.
Oh,
I really don't like it. So, you know, he's now pushing for... And hey, this is a good thing. He's pushing for Americans to get to Mars and have a moon base.
Yeah, I really think...
A moon base.
A moon base.
Being the commander-in-chief and the leader of the free world, I think he should lead us in that expedition in going to Mars. President Bush, I do believe, should be probably one of the first to go to Mars.
Yeah, by lead, he means physically be the first one in Mars.
Is this going to a joke or what?
No, it's just, I think that, you know,
he should go back where he came from.
Or that, you know, he talks about all this, all these things that he doesn't know much about. And so here's the opportunity that he wants these people to, you know, he wants us to go there. So why doesn't he go first? It kind of borderlines, parallels my thing of he likes to go to war quite a bit. I think he should actually go to war and be on the front lines. And then what will he, you know, how would his decisions change in the future?
They didn't have a guy come out, okay, let me just finish this. So, yeah, basically he's pushing to get the space thing on track and do a little bit of what Kennedy did. and go down the books for trying to go to Mars. So trying to get to Mars, and that's something that is seeing off in the future, not something that's near now. He wants a new space vehicle created, and he would like to have humans on the moon living there.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, actually, there was some, just talking about Bush, some things I like, some things I don't. So I think sometimes the Democrats just putt around and sit on their ass a lot, and sometimes I think the Republicans go a little too far. So, just to mention, though, there's some talk coming out now that there was plans for war to go to Iraq before 9/11, and one of his prior cabinet members, which resigned, is coming out with this information. So,
oh yeah, well, they did also some interesting like infrastructure, special energy and infrastructure analysis on Iraq and Afghanistan that was not a part of the Dick Cheney's main report of other countries of what their infrastructure and power supplies were, because he's on the Energy Commission, that those were kind of kept on the back burner.
Yep.
I think they were just used for justification of why, you know, and how we can go over there and do that.
Yep.
And acquire more resources. And
well, I guess let's just say something. I just want to say this real quick, and obviously it'll probably be a response, but I think it's good to plant politically, to try to plant the American seed over there, not religiously, but not in our lifestyle either, but like of the democracy, because I think what they're trying to do is get us, win some people's minds over there, hopefully. So the anger for, you know, the West Coast or whatever, the West or whatever, is not as bad, because there's so much so many people trying to produce so much hate, you know, even if they don't even know us. So I think that was part of it. And I think the other part, too, was to put American products and businesses and our allies' products and businesses in Iraq to help it recoup. So on the business front, you know, I think that's what it was for.
And also to obtain cheaper and more direct flow of oil.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah.
And yet, so, gas prices have still not gone down.
No, they won't. No,
no, because then the gas, gas and oil industry make more money, and so they can support those politicians and who help their cause. It's a little vicious cycle.
The circle of capitalism.
But I really, really do support the kind of trying to infuse democracy into the Middle East, because
it was just a festering thing that's just ready to blow up on itself.
Well, like how Saddam Hussein was really able to keep power is because he was such a tyrant, because all these people want to kill each other. Well, why do they want to kill each other? It's because they don't communicate.
And the environment sucks.
Right, and so you really need to communicate, use the resources more efficiently, and one of the best ways to do that is through democracy and capitalism.
Yeah, so if the outcome is that America makes a little bit of money, gets a little bit cheaper oil, our allies that are in there, business is going, economies are going, they get all the cool stuff, they're free, they're able to speak, and hopefully they can coexist with the different tribes and stuff like that, and invent a constitution and a set of laws that they'll be happy with. No one's really ever happy, but a good set of things
that they can at least come to a consensus on.
Yeah, and we can do something to try to stop the violence as far as all the killing and stuff like that of people on both sides,
because it's much easier to write a bill and get the world changed than trying to kill thousands of people.
Well, yeah. But I think since it was such a big thing, you had to just do that. But, you know, maybe the intentions weren't great, weren't right, and the story wasn't right. But if everyone can come out on top, you know, in all areas that are involved, then I guess it's not a bad thing. But obviously there's still a lot to happen over there before things work out. So, all right. Well, that wasn't planned, but it was definitely good to have. Okay, well, people have overclocked computers before in the past, and they've also done it with liquid nitrogen in the past. So this is just an attempt to take the newest, the fastest Pentium 4 out there, which I believe is 3.2 or 3.4 gigahertz. I think it was a 3.4, I don't know. Basically, they brought up to 5.25 gigahertz, offering at like negative 100-some degrees. Let's see if I can find it here. pretty freaking cold. You know, I was curious, you know, when it's at like negative 100, how the hell does anything even switch?
Well, actually, that's when it starts becoming a like a semiconductor or a superconductor. But it's not quite, because really a superconductor works at like no heat, because there's no friction, because it's perfect in its mechanical movement. Because that's really what it is. It's this mechanical, electrical, you know, on or off.
Well, yeah, I mean, these switches, you know, can keep firing. I'm sure there's a limit, you know, but they're going to keep firing well beyond their normal spec of running, because they're cooled with a system that obviously they're not going to be producing for consumers all the time. And it's much less heat to have to deal with without the core melting, so they're able to overclock it.
Because as the heat, you know, the atoms move with heat, and so when they're super cool, they move even less. And so the mechanical nature of it is even more efficient, because it's right there.
Yeah. All right, well, we talked about this before, but I guess it's just more of an update about the Ministry of Finance for Israel decided, obviously, not to go and upgrade to the new Microsoft Office or purchase any Office products, period, and just continue to stick. So what they're doing now is they're sticking with what they have Microsoft-wise. They're not upgrading it. And they are obviously supporting open source, you know, other options to be able to come forth and be the de facto. So obviously OpenOffice is one of them, and I think it's the one. And they're just focusing on that. And I don't know if it's financially or if they're bringing some of their top programmers over to help work with it. But Microsoft is really, really trying hard to get their business again. So they are willing to split up Microsoft Office into different, like, Outlook separate, PowerPoint separate, stuff like that. They're like, well, we'll cut the price. They're like, well, we don't care. You know, we still want to do this. They're like, well, what? Well, how about we just don't include applications you don't need? And then you're paying for that. So they still said no, but it's kind of interesting that they're willing to actually split it up for that point.
Yeah, but not under the...
Not for other things, though. Not in monopoly cases or anything like that. So
yeah, I think that's rather interesting.
So that's more about the snake of Microsoft out there. And, wow, we're actually, even though we're talking about a lot of different things, we're just going to make time and all the stories.
Right on.
Okay, well.
Double success on that.
Yes. Believe that January 5th is a day. I think it is a day where, yep, January 5th, that GNU free software is 20 years old.
Woo!
Happy birthday, GNU.
Yeah, that's right.
Happy birthday. So, it was 20 years ago today that I quit my job at MIT to begin developing, this from Richard Stallman, a free software operating system, GNU. While we have never released a complete GNU system, which means that their kernel HERD doesn't quite work very well, suitable for production use, a variant of the GNU system is now used by tens of millions of people who mostly are not aware of what it is, basically. Free software does not mean gratis. It means that the users are free to run the program, study the source code, change it, and redistribute it either with or without changes, either gratis or for a fee. My hope was that the free operating system would open a path to escape forever from the system of subjugation, which is proprietary software. I had experienced the ugliness of the way of life that a non-free software imposes on its users, and I was determined to escape it and give others a way to escape. Non-free software carries with it an antisocial system that prohibits cooperation in the community. You are typically unable to see the source code. You cannot tell what nasty tricks or what foolish bugs it may contain. If you don't like it, you are helpless to change it. Worst of all, you are forbidden to share it with anyone else. To prohibit sharing software is to cut the bonds of society.
Right on. It's just language.
Yeah.
It's just another social tool.
Today we have a large community of users who run GNU Linux and other free software. Thousands of people who like to extend this and have adopted the goal of convincing other, more computer users to use free software. But what does it mean to use free software? Does that mean escaping from proprietary software and merely installing free programs alongside it? Or are we aiming to lead people to freedom or just introduce them to our work. In other words, are we working for freedom, or have we replaced that goal with the shallow goal of popularity? It's easy to get in the habit of overlooking this distinction because in many common situations, it makes no difference. When you're trying to convince a person to try a free program or install the GNU Linux operating system, either goal would lead to the same practical conduct. However, in other situations, the two goals inspire very different actions. For instance, what should we say when the non-free NVIDIA's video driver, the non-free proprietary database, or the non-free Indonesia language interpreter and libraries is released in a version that runs on GNU Linux? Should we thank the developers for the support of our system, or should we prepare this non-free program like any other as an attractive nuisance and a temptation to accept bondage, a problem to be solved? If you take as your goal the increasing popularity of certain free software, if you seek to convince more people, turn the page, to use some free programs like some programs some of the time, you might think those non-free programs are helpful contributions to that goal. It's hard to dispute the claim that their availability helps make GNU Linux more popular. If the widespread use of GNU or Linux is the ultimate goal of your community, of our community, we should logically applaud all applications that run on it, whether free or not. But if our goal is freedom, that changes everything. Users cannot be free while using a non-free program to free the citizens of a cyberspace. We have to replace those non-free programs, not accept them. They are not contributions to our community. They are temptations to settle for continuing non-freedom. There are two common motivations to develop a free program. One is that there is a program to do the job. Unfortunately, accepting the use of non-free program eliminates this motivation. The other is that there is the will to be free, which motivates people to write free replacements for non-free programs. In cases like this, that motive is the only one that can do the job. Simply by using a new and unfinished free replacement before it technically compares to a non-free model, you can help encourage the free developers to persevere until it becomes superior. These non-free programs are not trivial. Developing free replacements for them will be a big job. It may take years. The work may need the help of future hackers, young people today, people yet to be inspired to join the work on free software. What can we do today to help convince other people in the future to maintain the necessary determination and persistence to finish this work? The most effective way to strengthen our community for the future is to spread our understanding of the value of freedom, to teach more people to recognize the moral unacceptability of non-free software. People who value freedom are, in the long term, its best and essential defense. And basically what he's saying is that GNU Linux does use proprietary stuff sometimes. You know, if you're running like IBM's DB2 on top of it, database system, or some of the stuff that's in Wine is proprietary, like WineX, I think. I even think some of the stuff in Wine is proprietary, closed-sourced. Some things in X Windows is closed-sourced. And he's basically saying, like, it's great that Linux is progressing, but is it really great if it's progressing and we're allowing tools and programs to come in that are not open source into the system? So
I kind of got from that is like underlying philosophy is that choice and your own control is freedom. Really, it is. And when you don't have that choice or control of whatever you have around you, you are sublimated by it. What your tool is actually your master. Very insightful.
Yeah. So basically, he was kind of trying to give the call to people to write replacements for X Windows, which is being done, replacements for other things out there that are proprietary, that have made their way into GNU Linux or partially proprietary. So to have a complete free system. Okay, well, John Johansson, the guy that brought us DCSS, or the decryption software for it, and the guy that unlocked the iTunes music, basically allowed it to be ported out to QuickTime, and removed the DRM technology in there to digital rights management technology. Well, he's done something else. He's made it so it can be played on Linux.
Right on.
So, let's see. The Norwegian programmer John Lech Johansson, who broke the DVD encryption scheme, has opened iTunes Lock Music a tad bit further by allowing people to play songs they've purchased on iTunes Music store on their GNU Linux computers. We're about to find out what Apple really thinks about fair use, John Johansson told the Register via email. Basically, how it works is Johansson deduced that the system key that locks the music, that locks the locked music to a single Windows computer is derived from four facts: the serial number of the C drive, the system BIOS version, the CPU name, and the Windows product ID. When you run the VideoLAN client under Windows, it will write the user key to a file. The user key is a system dependent and can thus be used by a GNU Linux version of VideoLAN clients, he explains. So by using that, I guess I don't quite understand it because I didn't really read much into how it works. But I think by taking that key and moving it over into Linux, it allows you to take the files that you have and play it over there. I think that's what it means. So
that it actually kind of like writes those keys for.
Yeah, so now it's portable.
It holds those out for the player.
So, very interesting. And the last bit of information is we were talking about it on the other show, about, of course, SCO trying to go out and get people to sign up for their pathetic licensing program. And they said that they were going to go after a major company that is involved with Linux. And, of course, they're actually going after Google. So it's true that they have spoken with Google. And one of their quotes is, certainly if they're using 10,000 Linux servers that included our intellectual property as part of Unix, we would want them to license. So, I don't know.
Wait, didn't one of the last articles actually say that they didn't even have a leg to stand on?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, there's a lot of they don't have
I'm
a leg.
I'm pretty sure every single article has touched on that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that they don't have a leg.
Well, no, that they even released it, and, like, one of their employees even said, no, that's not.
Yeah, but the case isn't done, and their propaganda isn't finished, and stuff like that. So
that was actually Linus Torvalds, who actually was on one of the team that looked at the code, and he looked at it, and he's like, "I wrote that."
Well, yeah, that was that one code, that Erno H. But there's other stuff for the JFS and few of the kernel implementations of. Was it SMS or it's for multiprocessing,
yeah,
stuff like that?
Symmetric multiprocessing.
So, yeah. So
hopefully Google's not going to freak out. That they're just going to go, I think we're going to wait on that.
Should hope so, too.
Yeah, it's kind of stupid. I mean, how can you charge for something that is not, right now is in the air? You know, it's just.
That's kind of like proclaiming, I own all the air rights, and. You're going to start paying me for
until
every
you
breath.
Can prove me wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
But I won't let you prove me wrong because
I don't
have to. Exactly.
I'm a stupid monkey. So, all right.
Just call SCO a stupid monkey.
Yes, the great corn scolio. I need IP for my bunghole. So, yeah. Well, that's all the info we got. Unless anyone else got some info.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Great show.
Yeah, yeah.
Good job, co-host Slip Mode.
Yeah, co-host Slip Mode.
Co-host Slip Mode holding it down.
I was holding it down the whole time.
Good anchor there.
I was holding down the mute button on certain people. No. We don't have one of those. Okay, well,
We should set that up for the next show. That would be very helpful.
With a mute button?
Yeah, a mute button.
We'd all just be silent.
Maybe
everybody
would
be holding down everybody's mute button.
Then all of a sudden, actually, you'd see me talking. I'm like, yeah. Then you'd hear, VR over there. Like, whoa, then I'm like, and then, like, disappears, and I'm, like, talking. I'm like, yeah, so what's going on? And all of a sudden, you hear this, like...
No, Bob comes on and says, there's a slight skirmish in the studio right now.
We're experiencing some technical
VR and Slip Mode passed
please
out.
Please bear with us.
I am now changing the show into the Big Gay Al show. I'm going to talk about what Big Gay Al would like to talk about, because he deserves a voice.
And all his big gay animals.
For the people. Okay, well, that wraps it up. I'll see everyone in 2 weeks. This is co-host Slip Mode signing out.
Later.
And this is Bob, out.
All right, see you then.